Okay, so the one on the right, I gave the reference to important papers from last spring on this subject, which were papers by Pennington and Admiry, Engelhardt, Marv, and Maxfield.
Okay, good. So if you can keep the font size.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, so if you just keep the font size on the left, it should be fine. Let me hit the record button and then I'll introduce you and I can get started.
Very good. Yeah. If you don't hear me or something cannot be seen, please let me know.
Yes, everyone do speak up if it gets too fancy. Okay, so here we go. Okay, so thanks everyone for tuning in. For this seminar, we're delighted to have Juan Maldacena from Institute of Advanced Study, who's going to tell us about Hawking radiation and recent work on black holes and wormholes and things. So Juan, thank you very much for giving this talk, and take it away.
Yeah, sure, it's a pleasure. So this talk is going to be based on works that were inspired by two very nice papers, very important papers that were written last spring. One by Jeff Pennington, and the other one by Almeri, Engelhardt, Marov, and Maxfield. And then there were a sequence of papers that several other people wrote, including myself. And I will try to give you a little bit of an overview and give you some opportunity to ask questions mainly, so please ask questions. Because there are already several talks online on this work. Some are at the IIS workshop website. And there are talks by Pennington and Marianne Mark on Stanford. There are also talk of Maxfield on slightly connected subject. And there have been talks at the KITP recent conference, so you can find there more talks online. So I think the opportunity here is just to be more interactive, and please ask me questions. Okay, so now, the first point I would like to make is what is the RT formula, the Ruta-Kanagi formula? Okay, I think this is probably well known to all of you, but I'd like to emphasize it. So the Ruta-Kanagi formula is an extension of the black hole entropy formula that computes the fine-grained entropy of a black hole or of a state. I like to emphasize this aspect of the formula. The formula originally was derived and mainly talked about in the context of subregions in ADS-CFT. And certainly, you can think of the entropy of a subregion as computing the fine-grained entropy of that subregion. But when you are dealing with black holes, you are considering the whole black hole, and you are attempting to compute the fine-grained entropy of the black hole, and that's what the Ruta-Kanagi formula is computing. This is in contrast to the standard Hawking-Bekenstein formula, defined as the area of the horizon, which computes the thermodynamic entropy of the black hole. So, for example, and something important is that the Ruta-Kanagi formula knows about the black hole interior. So the Hawking-Bekenstein formula, the area of the horizon, sort of kind of stops at the horizon and tells us that the thermodynamic entropy of the black hole or the coarse-grained entropy of the black hole is equal to the horizon area. While the RT formula allows us to, the value of the RT entropy depends on the interior of the black hole. So black holes with different interiors will give us different entropies. So, for example, if we have a collapsing black hole, so this is a black hole in flat space that forms from collapse. So we have the matter that makes the black hole. Okay. So this is the usual diagram, and so we want to compute the RT entropy. So from outside, the black hole looks like some black hole, and we define some cutoff surface around the black hole at some sufficient distance where we can neglect the main quantum gravity effects. So here, that cutoff surface is somewhere here. And then at different times, we can compute the entropy, so at each point in time, so let's say at this point in time in the evolution of the system, we can decide to compute the fine-grained entropy. Then we're instructed to find the extremal surface, so the minimal area surface on this slice, and then we expert maximize over all possible slices. And in this particular case, the minimum extremal surface is just the trivial surface, and we get the whole region swept by the searching from this minimal surface. If you take a Cauchy slice that goes from the point in question, where at the time at which we are computing the minimal surface to the actual extremal surface, and then we consider the causal development of that, or the domain of dependence of that surface, we get the space-time region. So these are supposed to be 45 degree lines that we call the entanglement wedge. In this particular case, the entropy is supposed to be the area over form G plus the matter entropy, or more precisely the quantum field theory entropy of the fields in this region, including the graviton, if there is any. So that's also included. And so that's the actual entropy of this region. Now, in this particular case, we don't have the area contribution, which has the entropy, which would be the entropy of the matter that made the star. Now, we could choose to compute the same thing at a later time. So this is before the black hole has formed, so before the horizon has formed. And we can compute the same thing at a later time. Well, first of all, at a later time, we can compute the area of the horizon. And so in this case, we get the area of the horizon. Well, when we could go in along a library or some other time, but we get basically the area of the horizon in this region, depending on exactly how we define it. So that's the thermodynamic entropy. It would be the area of the horizon over 40 newton. And this would be much bigger than the entropy of the matter that made the star. On the other hand, even at this time, we could compute the entropy using the Ruta-Ganayan formula, and again we get the zero area, and we get an entropy which is just the entropy of the quantum field theory. So this we get the same as this formula, and because we have unitary evolution here in this region, and assuming we didn't have much Hawking radiation or other stuff coming in, the entropy will be basically the entropy on this surface is going to be basically the entropy of the star, the same as what we had before. Okay. So that's the Ruta-Ganayan formula in action. Now we have something different if we had an internal black hole, for example. So in that case, we have a Penrose diagram more of this kind, where we have two exteriors. And then now we have our cutoff surface somewhere here, and we decide to compute the entropy at some time here. Then the extremal area lies at this point, and so we get an entanglement wedge which has this form and an entropy which is equal. So in this case, the entropy, the fine grain entropy computed by the Ruta-Ganayan formula, ends up being equal to the thermodynamic entropy and equal to the area of the horizon divided by 40. Okay. So depending on what the geometry of the black hole behind the horizon is, we can get two different answers for the fine grain entropy. Okay. Good. So that's first point. Now, I'd like to say a few words about the derivation of the Ruta-Ganayan formula. And this is older work by Lekowitz and myself and Faulkner. And it's actually related to the derivation of the entropy formula that was done by Gibbons and Hawking. And in some sense, it's a small variation on what Gibbons and Hawking did. So I remind you what Gibbons and Hawking did. So Gibbons and Hawking said, well, we consider the geometry of the Euclidean black hole, and which has a geometry like this. So this is the
radial direction, and this direction here is Euclidean time, which is has some period theta. So they viewed this geometry as computing a path integral in gravity, where they fixed the boundary conditions at infinity, which so that we have a Euclidean circle times an S2. So we have an S1 of size beta times an S2. And then they fill in the geometry, and they interpret this gravitational path integral as the action, minus the action of the gravitational action, is interpreted as a log of Z, where as a log of a partition function. And from this, you can calculate the entropy by the usual formula of taking 1 minus beta dd beta of the log of the partition function. Okay. And while this formula, the value of this depends on the whole geometry, the value of the entropy depends only on the area of the horizon at this point. So the point where it's a fixed point under the rotation symmetry. Okay. The idea is that in the rest of the geometry, the U1 symmetry is acting as a translation. And the answer is proportional essentially to the length of the circle, and anything proportional to the length of the circle cancels in this formula, while the contribution from here is does not have that character, gives a constant contribution, and that's what picks it. And this formula therefore picks out the contribution. Yeah, that's roughly how you can say it. I'll say it in a slightly better way later. Now you can also take out this formula in a slightly different point of view. So you can say, you can cut open, you can imagine that you cut open this path integral, where you do the path integral along a circle, and you can view it as giving you a formula for the or a path integral representation for the density matrix of the system. So, and here also you can have a cut that goes. So there, here we get, we have a density matrix for the full state of the system. And then you can imagine taking, computing trace. You can think about the computation of trace of rho. Well, you can view this as a computation of trace of rho for an unnormalized density matrix. So this is not really the density matrix, it's just unnormalized. And this, when we close it here, we are just computing trace of rho. But similarly, we could compute trace of rho to the n. So this is simply would be putting together n of these geometries. And in this particular case, we get the circle, which is 10 times bigger. And this is, again, a computation that can be done with this geometry. And then we compute the entropy by the formula 1 minus n dn log of these traces of rho to the n. This is sometimes called Cn, the partition function of the nth replica. And this again, when we set n equal to 1, gives us the entropy. Now, the advantage of this is that it can also be generalized to computations where the thing we do here is not translation invariant and the translations in the circle. So we could be, for example, modifying the path integral by inserting some operators in this region. I'm going to represent that by this little wiggle. The little wiggle means that we are inserting some operators, for example. In this case now, when we, in this case, when we take the nth copy, we will have, let's say for example, three copies, we concatenate three of these geometries with the wiggle. And so the boundary conditions at large values of rho or r will consist of n copies of the original boundary conditions. In particular, the boundary conditions will have a Cn symmetry. under, if you wish, a rotation of all the three copies. And then we are instructed to fill in these geometries in all possible ways. And when we fill them in, it often happens that you can fill them in with a CN invariant geometry, and the geometry will have some fixed points under the CN action. Now, one important point is that the inside can be filled in many different ways. And this will be important for what we will say later. But I remind you that even in the original Evans and Hogan calculation, you can have different ways of filling in the geometries. So for example, if you have an S1 and an S2, which is what we were discussing before, so we can have the usual black hole solution where the S1 shrinks to zero, but the S2 shrinks to some finite size, so that gives us the black hole contribution with, where the entropy is non-zero. Or you could have the situation where the S1 does not shrink and the S2 shrinks to zero. Okay, and in this case, the entropy is equal to zero. So this is the this flat space example. This would be like just flat space with the time identified, and depending on the situation, one can dominate over the other. For example, you might be familiar with the case of anti-Sitter space, where depending on the size of the circle, either this one dominates or this other geometry dominates the thermal ensemble. And the transition between the two is called the Hopkins-Page transition. Okay. Now, given that we have this type of transitions in the computation of the thermal, in the computation of this usual computation of the entropy for the U1 symmetric situation, in this case that we don't have precisely a U1 symmetry, we could also in principle have the same transition. And we'll see that those transitions play a very important role for what we will discuss. Okay, so now, so far we've been discussing the computation of these geometries. And when we compute the action, so our objective now is to compute the action for the nth space like this, and then eventually take the limit when n goes to 1. So we're not so, we don't care so much about the non-zero cases, so the cases where n is an integer, but we care mostly about the case where n is very close to 1. So if we have the log of this n is going to be given by minus the gravitational action on the manifold m. And well, plus maybe the matter contribution, plus log C matter. So this is the quantum field theory contribution, and this is the gravitational action.
Juan?
Yes.
Juan? Can you write a tiny bit bigger?
Yeah, sure. This one was smaller. This one.
Thanks a lot.
For the M case. Now, this piece, we're now going to assume that we have a geometry with a CN symmetry. Okay, so that's an assumption. There is a question of whether in any case the geometries without the CN symmetry dominates. So in most cases that have been discussed, it's assumed that these geometries with the CN symmetry dominate, and I'll discuss a little bit what happens when one case where not, doesn't quite happen. So, so in that case, the action will be n times the gravitational action on a space which is a CN quotient of the previous space, plus, well, this is the same. Okay. So what is this CN quotient? The CN quotient would be, so we take this, which has the n copies, and we take the CN quotient, it will be the geometry which will have only one copy of the boundary, but here you will have a conical singularity. The singularity is totally fictitious in the sense that it arose only because we did the quotient and it wasn't present in the original geometry. Now, when we look at the gravitational action in this geometry, we will evaluate the square root of g in R, and we here there is a question of whether we should or should not include contribution, curvature contribution from here at the tip. Okay. Now, in the original geometry, there was no curvature singularity at the tip, so there was no special contribution at the tip. And so here, in principle, we should not include it. So here is not included. But we can write it as we can include it and remove it. So we can include it. So now we include the curvature singularity here. So when we calculate the action, and we subtract the piece that we actually included, which is a piece that is an integral over a co-dimension 2 surface, sigma d minus 2. Okay. So this is a co-dimension 2 surface. It's basically the sphere, in this case, was the 2 sphere that was sitting here. And so now we can view this as an action, which is we have a manifold and we have a brain whose tension, a co-dimension 2 brain or cosmic string, a cosmic brain. So this is a brain that in general dimensions has co-dimension 2, so 2 transverse dimensions, and has some tension which goes to 0 when n is very close to 1. And produces a deficit angle around the cosmic brain, which is 2 pi over n is the opening angle around this point. Okay. So now we were instructed by this formula to take the nth derivative and then set this n close to 1. Now, the advantage of having done this is that now the boundary conditions of the problem are n independent, and all the explicit n dependence of the problem is just here in the tension of the brain. Okay. So that's where the twisted independences, at least in the gravitational piece. When we think about the matter piece, there is another independence, which comes from the fact that we consider matter on this manifold, and then we're inserting here a twist operator, which exchanges in the n copy. So we have matter on n copies of this manifold, which is the same as matter in this original geometry. And at this point, we have inserted the, from this point of view, inserted the twist operator that exchanges the n copies. Okay. So here it's just that operator just simply enforcing that we have smooth boundary conditions on the original geometry, that we simply have this original manifold. It's just constructing the original manifold. Very well. So the problem then becomes the same as considering these cosmic brains with these twist operators inserted. And now, when we compute this derivative, there is a piece where the derivative acts on this action, and that will give. So now we are computing the entropy, and perhaps I will say this slightly differently. The geometry for n close to 1 is going to be very close to the geometry for n equal to 1. Okay. So that geometry will be a small variation on the geometry with n equal to 1. And the geometry with n equal to 1 is a solution of the equations of motion. So when we vary this term in the action, we'll just get 0. So we have, we are taking the geometry with n equal to 1, and consider a small variation to explore what the geometry is going to be near n equal to 1. And so the variation of the first step in the action will give zero. So zero is the variation of this term. And then we have the action of this term, but this time is already of order n minus one. So here we put the background geometry. So here we have a term proportional to n minus one. I'm not keeping track of the signs. We have a square root of g times the action on this brain. And then we have the matter piece, and we can also expand the action of the matter piece near n equal to 1. And again, for the matter piece, the important part is that, well, there is a change in the metric that when we displace the metric, so this change in the metric affects both the gravitational part of the action and the matter, and because the gravitational action together with the matter was obeying the equations of motion, that gave the zero. And then we have some explicit independence that comes from the insertion of the twist operators, and so that will give us the entropy of the matter, so S matter. So this is something that comes from keeping the geometry fixed to be the one of n equal to one, and then inserting a twist operator very close to n equal to one, so this is some kind of analytic continuation. And taking the limit when n goes to one, we already get this boundary action. So very close to n equal to one, we get this times some factor of n minus one. And so now we are supposed to, we haven't yet imposed equations of motion completely. So we all that remains from the equations of motion is to minimize or extremize, more precisely, the sum of these two things. Okay? Which is, this is the area term, and this is the matter entropy. So then we get the formula, the final formula, which says that the entropy, is equal to the extremum of area over 40 newton plus S matter, or the entropy of the quantum field theory. Okay. Also, if we have more than one extremum, we should take the minimum over all those possible extremum. Okay. Very good. So this is the final formula for the entanglement, for the entropy, the fine grained entropy, and it was developed in a series of papers. So Ruth Takanagi, then Kubini, Rangamani, and Takanagi, and then Engelhardt and Wall, and it was then proven in various other papers. The paper that gave an argument like the one I've given you here, including the matter, the extremization including the matter, was in a paper by Dong and Lekowitz. Okay, so that's the story. Now, notice that we can let me know. What are the points I want to make? So so one point is that there are some boundary conditions that fix for us how many what computation we're doing, so what entanglement entropy we're computing, or what fine grained entropy we're computing. And then when we fill in the interior, there might be one fixed point of the CN action, no fixed point, and so on. And these fixed points of the CN action are the ones that are giving us these area contributions and are telling us in the quantum field theory what regions we should consider. Okay, so what are the regions of the geometry whose entropy we're considering. But the number of those fixed points is completely determined by the way we fill in the geometry. And for different ways of filling in the geometry, we could have different numbers. So for example, we'll see now an example an example of that, and that's important. So let's discuss now the application to black holes. So this formula. Okay, so now we're going to consider again the black hole that collapses. And let me see. Well, we already discussed the case of the black hole that was collapsing. Let's now discuss an evaporating black hole. So I remind you that for the case of black hole that collapsed, the root Akanagi surface was trivial. Now the black hole starts evaporating. So we have this is the horizon. We have some asymptotic region. We had the matter that made the black hole. And now the new feature is that we have Hawking radiation. So we have the modes, Hawking radiation modes that roughly speaking they're created in pairs. So we have some radiation going off to infinity. And the partner mode goes to the black hole singularity. And this is the process that happens on and on. Okay. So now when we compute, so we have now our cutoff surface here somewhere. And we say, well, we decide to compute the entropy at this point in time. Then when we draw these possible surfaces, and imagine the extremal surface is still the trivial surface here, we will include the entropy of this partners of Hawking radiation. Okay. That means that the entropy, so we computed the as a function of time, we computed the entropy of the black hole. This is the entropy of the black hole because what we're doing here is we're surrounding the black hole by some cutoff surface and computing the final entropy of everything that is inside. And initially that was equal to the entropy of matter. But as time goes on, that entropy starts rising due to the effects of Hawking radiation. Now, and it continues to rise in principle, and as the black hole evaporates, and eventually the black hole will end up with stop evaporating. And so if the final entropy that we get this way. If the black hole evaporates completely, so we calculate the entropy at some late time where the black hole evaporated completely, we would include this whole entropy of all the partners of Hawking radiation, and that entropy will achieve a maximum, which is the entropy of all these partners of Hawking radiation, basically, that would dominate over the entropy of matter, and it also is essentially equal to the entropy of Hawking radiation, all the partners outside, because the initial state for the radiation was pure. On the other hand, we have the thermodynamic entropy of the black hole. So this is the thermodynamic entropy of the black hole, which in general would be smaller than the entropy of Hawking radiation because of the second law. And that entropy sort of goes down. And so we have here a paradox that the fine-grained entropy at this point seems to be bigger than the coarse-grained entropy of the black hole. And that does not make sense in a unitary theory, in a theory that preserves information. So what Page has said is, no, what we should have is that the entropy should follow this curve. And it should follow this curve basically both for the black hole and for the radiation. The initial state was close to pure, so let me ignore the initial entropy of matter, so let's say it was zero. So if the initial state was pure, then the entropy of both the remaining black hole, as well as the entropy of the radiation, should go down to zero. So this result is what is sometimes called the Hawking curve. And the red answer is what's sometimes called the Page curve. So this is the curve that the black hole that follows, that is evolving unitarily, should follow. Okay, so it was for a long time exactly not clear how from the gravity computation we're going to reproduce this curve. Of course, if you assume, let's say, ADS-CFD and so on, then we know that the description of the boundary is unitary and so on.
and then we will in principle follow this curve. But the question is how gravity knows or how we see this curve in gravity. And the crucial insight of the two papers that I mentioned by Pennington and by Almeri, Engelhardt, Maroff, and Maxfield was to discover that at late times there is a second extremal surface. So if you do this computation at the late times, we have one extremal surface, which was the one we were talking about, the trivial surface, when there is nothing there. It's area zero. But then there is a second extremal surface, which is somewhat close to the horizon. And in that case, the entanglement wedge, or the region that is found by, well, the domain of dependence of the Cauchy slice that goes from here to here, from the cutoff surface to the extremal surface, the entanglement wedge is relatively small, and importantly, does not include most of the black hole interior. And the, since this extremal, second extremal surface, so this extremal surface arises from, it's important to consider the matter contribution. So remember that the formula for the entropy was supposed to minimize the area plus the entropy of the matter of the quantum field theory. And so the extremization balances these two terms. And this term is not burning too rapidly because it's close to the horizon where, at least in this direction, the entropy is not changing very much. While this entropy is burning a little more rapidly because of the effect of Hawking radiation. And so you can balance basically these two terms. And in that way, you obtain a second extremal surface, which is at this position. And because it's near the horizon, the actual value of the entropy is actually close to the area of the horizon. This giving a smaller contribution to the entropy, but a larger contribution to the first derivative, so that you can balance the two terms. And when you do that, then you get the value for the Feynman entropy, which is close to the thermodynamic entropy of the black hole. Okay, and in this way, you get the page curve of the black hole, and you would also get the page curve of the radiation. So if you say that, well, you could do this as computing also the entropy of radiation. Okay, so we have some radiation here. But you would get that answer only if you allow in the computation of the entropy of radiation to include this region. And including this region means that you are allowing a Kruta-Kanagi surface at this point, and including this cold region as part of radiation. Okay, so let's discuss this a little more. Now, what I just said is looks a little strange from the point of view of radiation, and let me try to emphasize it a little more. So the radiation system is not living in the gravitational region of the space-time, or the region where, let's say, gravity effects are small, are large. So this radiation, we could have collected it in a quantum computer where there is no gravity. But what we are saying is that if we want to compute the entropy of this radiation, we should, if we want to compute the entropy of this radiation using gravity, then we should also include this region in the black hole interior and the area of this point in the computation of the entropy. In other words, when we compute the entropy of the radiation, so we will have to extremize over all choice of islands. So we can imagine we include regions which are regions of the space-time geometry, and now compute the entropy of the quantum field theory of the radiation region union the islands plus the area of the islands over 40 Newton.
And these islands could be anywhere in the gravitational region. And it might be convenient to put them in because we can have here in this particular case, we have all the Hopi modes that are entangled with the interior modes. And if we include these islands, then the quantum field theory entropy will be smaller. Okay, so we make by including the islands, we make the quantum field theory smaller, but we raise the entropy because of the area of the island, of this area. But for an old black hole, this entropy is very large and larger than the area, so it's convenient to do this. Okay. So we make the entropy of the matter contribution very small, and we only pay the price of the area that gives us this island answer. this is sometimes called the island formula and so on. But this this formula is might look a little strange from the point of view of computing the entropy of the radiation, because the radiation system, as I said, it might be in a system that does not contain gravity, like a bunch of qubits or spins and so on. But we still have to use this formula because we use gravity to produce the state. Okay? So we use the, let's say, gravitational path integral to produce the final state on this whole slice. And since we use gravity, we should also use gravity to compute this entropy. Okay? And the gravitational formula gives us this result. And in addition, there is this this idea that the entanglement wedge is actually contained in the system whose entropy we're computing. So in this case, we're computing the entropy of the radiation. The so-called entanglement wedge, which are these regions are computing, are including the sense of bulk reconstruction, in the sense that if you have a small probe qubit here that you somehow send, we could, in principle, decode the state of that extra qubit by doing operations purely on the radiation. Okay. So this is a hypothesis, and there are some arguments that are correct. So there is this idea of the PETS map. It was in the Stanford paper. And also, there was a paper by Yimin Chen from Princeton, who discussed how to do this in the case that the bulk theory is pre-fermion theory by using the modular Hamiltonian and so on. If you have questions, I'll discuss that a little bit more. Okay, now, okay, so let me try to emphasize a little more where these islands, island contributions are coming from, and how they arise by thinking about the gravitational path integral. Are there any questions? Maybe I should have paused for questions. No.
No questions here in Potsdam. If anyone else has a question, feel free to speak up. We can't see the chat window. So if you, I see there's somebody wrote something there. Let's see.
What can you see?
You wrote, isn't the Hawking curve continuing to grow for all times?
Okay. So yeah. So this is the Hawking curve for the case that of a black hole that evaporates completely, right? So we form a black hole, the black hole evaporates, and this is the point where it finishes evaporating. And after that, the Hawking curve remains constant. Is that clear? You might have heard about, I was going to talk about another setup where the Hawking curve rises forever, but in this is the one for an evaporating black hole. This is roughly what was in Page's paper. So these two curves, this plot was in Page's paper.
Thanks. They wrote that was clear. I should have mentioned at the beginning, when this talk is running, the chat window doesn't show up. So if you have a question, please unmute your mic and speak up, because we will not see the chat. So if anyone has a question, then don't use the chat.
Question?
Yeah.
So when you use these other minimal area surface, should I think that there is a backreacted CN invariant geometry which sort of where the
yes, indeed, yes. Yes. This comes from some other geometry. I was planning to discuss that next, but yes. So there is the one geometry, the geometry that gives the Hawking curve, essentially consists of essentially n copies of the. So let's say we are computing the entropy of radiation, right? And then the one that gives the Hawking curve consists of basically n copies of the black hole, separate copies. And then the entropy that the one that gives the Page curve contains connections between the black hole interiors, between the n black hole interiors. So that's the difference between the two.
Another question: these two terms in the entropy, the gravitational one and the QFT one, should we think about them as the first two terms in some loop expansion, or not?
Good. Yes. Yeah. So this. That's an important point I should have emphasized when we were talking about the derivation. This formula is correct basically when we think about gravity essentially classically, right? So the gravitational path integral, we did some saddle point evaluation of the integral, but the matter could be quantum and could give an important back reaction to the gravitational path integral. It's let me say something analogous. So imagine you have a bunch of quantum particles, let's say all free fermions that are living in some space, but there are so many of them that they generate a lot of gravity. And so even though the matter particles are quantum, you can still solve the gravitational equations, but you have to include the source, you have to include the quantum effects of matter, for example, the Fermi exclusion principle and so on. So that's what we do when we solve for the equation of a neutron star, for example.
So I should worry about extra terms that will become important when these two terms are comparable.
Yes, you should worry about those. In fact, the idea is that in this formula, we haven't worried about those. Okay. That these are this formula is correct when the gravitational part of the path integral has a saddle point. There is an interesting effect that happens at this point here when there are these two contributions that have similar sizes. In the paper by the people at Stanford, they consider this in the context of a simple JT gravity model. And there they found that in order to get the transition between the two curves, they had to sum over several geometries, which were many of which were not CN invariant. Okay, so you had to sum over all of them to get the shape of the curve properly. So that's a case where you need to do more than what I have just said. Okay. So what I've said here is correct away from these points where the two are comparable.
Thank you.
There are a few things that are, I think, still unclear about some aspects of this formula. So, for example, the precise way that the entropy of gravitons should be computed in theories that have propagating gravitons. So exactly what are the boundary conditions and so on. So some boundary conditions have been proposed in the literature, for example, in one of my papers. But no one, as far as I know, did the concrete computation of a case where we have propagating gravitons and found the entropy to be in agreement with the entropy that is computed using the Gibbons-Hawking method. But those are supposed to be details that are not affecting this. So here, the important aspect of this formula is that the matter contribution that is dominating at late times and is given the transition between the two is really localized far away from the horizon, right? It's this radiation piece which is far away from the entangling surface or the root Akanaya surface. So these details are not supposed to affect the basically balance between these two large terms. And so, for example, if you had a black hole that evaporated purely into gravitons, there will be the contribution of the gravitons that are far away, and then some contribution here of the gravitons near the are the surface, and here we're making the assumption that those are under some control and don't give something very large. And so the large contributions come from the gravitons far away, which where we can treat them essentially as free particles. Any other question? I mean, part of the insight of these papers is that there is this situation where the quantum field theory contribution can get large and effectively balance against the area term. So it's not just an extra term in the expansion. It's not always a small thing. It can be a dominant. It can be an important contribution. That's what is happening here. Any other question? So I was planning now to discuss a little more explicitly the type of geometries that give rise to these regions of entanglement wedge in the black hole interior. So the setup is a simple setup for the information paradox that one could consider, and it's a information paradox for the eternal black hole. So we can have an eternal black hole. So this is some cutoff surface, and we are going to ignore gravity here to this region, so there is no gravity. There will be gravity in this region inside. So let me again denote by green the gravitational region. Okay, so we have gravity here. And this is a state that we prepare by a Euclidean path integral that gives us the state, let's say, at t equal to zero. And then we evolve the state, we get the black hole interior here and so on. And the gravitational path integral that we are doing is basically an integral where we have a Euclidean space, something like a circle. So we can, when we go to Euclidean time, so this direction becomes essentially a circle. And so we have a gravitational region here, the Euclidean black hole, and then some essentially flat space-like region outside. If we were doing this with flat space, this region here outside would have the topology of a cylinder, so a constant, the size would have constant radius. Anyway, but we can think of this as preparing a state at t equal to zero that then we evolve. And when we do that, and we look at the modes that propagate, so let's say we have this left moving mode, this entangled with this left moving mode, and so on, right? So this other left moving mode, this entangled with this other left moving mode, etc. So now we can compute the entropy of radiation. So let's say we consider everything that is to the right of this, and everything to the left of that, and everything that is to the right of this, and compute the entropy of that. So that's so that entropy is not going to be very large, because we catch this all these modes here are entangled with all the modes on the other side, and the entropy is not going to be very large. It's going to be, well, from the points, from this point of view, it's just going to be zero. So we're going to draw here, maybe I'll draw it here on this side. As a function of time, we're going to compute the entropy of radiation, and so we start with some low entropy. And then we compute the same thing at the later time. So this is a later time size. And now we see that, for example, this mode that was entangled with this one falls out of this piece, but still contained on that one. And so this will give us a slightly bigger entropy than the one we had before. And therefore, we start getting an entropy which will rise. And actually, this entropy will sort of rise forever. Okay. So this is the entropy
of the quantum fields on this separation, so the form and entropy of the quantum fields on this separation. Now, this, if you view this entropy as produced by the two entangled black holes, this entropy cannot rise forever. This entropy has to saturate at the value which should be not bigger than twice the black hole entropy. So there is here twice the black hole entropy. And so the thermodynamic entropy of the system is here, the two black holes. And the entropy of the radiation should not go higher than that. And so the question is, what prevents it from going higher? And the idea is that applying this island formula, you can think that there is an island that develops here in this region of the geometry. This particular case, it extends a little bit into the black hole exterior, but that's just a small detail. It's very near the black hole horizon. But now we include this whole region. And when we do that, so what this does is that we will now include Hopping modes that were previously, so let's say one that was falling in here, that was entangled with one that was here. So this one, when we didn't have the island, would have contributed to the entropy, but now that we have the island, it does not contribute to the entropy anymore. And basically, at late times, we end up catching most of the partners of the Hopping modes that are either here or there. And so the Hopping radiation does not contribute much to this entropy, but we have a contribution from the area of these surfaces. And that is basically twice the entropy of the black hole. So we get this page. So this would be the page curve. This is the Hopping curve. Okay, now from the point of view of the geometries, the way that this arises is the following. So here I've drawn the, I'm going to draw a smaller. So when we look at the replica geometries for, let's say, for any but the two, for example, we will have two copies of the diagram we just discussed, where we have. We have the black hole, and then we have the these radiation regions, and we are just to put some boundary conditions that connect these two copies. So this is the usual replica trick. And in the first geometry, so the Hopping geometry, we that the geometry that gives the Hopping curve, we fill in these gravitational regions with two separate Euclidean black holes. So this is the Hopping curve. This will end up giving us the Hopping curve. And on the other hand, if we look, but we could also have another geometry. So we also have these two circles here. And we have, again, this, well, this is the same. So this cut here set up the boundary conditions. So they are in the region without gravity. And now in the region with gravity, we could also have some cuts that connect these two geometries. And those, if we put the cut that connects these two, the final topology that we have is that of cylinder, if you wish, that connects these two regions. So here we had two separate disks, so black hole interiors are not connected. But here we have a cylinder that connects the two black hole interiors. Before we were discussing the projection of this onto a single geometry and then putting in branch cuts in that geometry. Can you see this?
Yes.
That's visible for us, yes.
So we have the two branch cuts outside, and now the new feature is that we have these branch cuts inside. Okay. When we take n very close to one, this branch cut inside is what gives us this island here. Okay, so what should you take from this? So the following points. So first, that there is an interesting black hole information paradox already for the eternal black hole. So we don't have to worry about back reaction of the black hole. It's just the black hole in thermal equilibrium. So it's the thermofield level of two black holes, and there is radiation coming in and going out and so on. And already in this setup, there is an information paradox. The information paradox is resolved by thinking about these new geometries, these new topologies that contribute to the computation of the Rayleigh entropies. And when n goes to one, that these new topologies give rise to this sort of island formula for the computation of the entropy, which is basically not really just a minor extension of what was already understood before about the Ruta-Kanagi discussion. And notice that the transition between this curve and that curve is a transition in which this topology contributes to the Rayleigh entropy. So it's sort of like a hopping page transition. So the transition between the page curve and the Hawking page is a Hawking page transition. That's supposed to be a joke, but okay. In other words, we are using one paper of Hawking but to solve a paradox that was proposed in a different paper of Hawking. The paper of Hawking and Page to solve that one. Okay. Now I'd like to finish by mentioning one other connection, which is the following. You might be a bit surprised that different topologies are contributing to this computation, right? Why is not normally effects of different topologies are very small. So why is it that they become relevant for this kind of calculation? So one way to understand it at the level of this diagram is the following, that suppose we are computing the second Rayleigh entropy, so rather not the entropy, but this quantity, which is the trace of rho squared, which is what we were computing over there. And so let's say trace of rho is normalized to one. When we compute trace of rho squared, for a state with very low entropy, it's going to give us one. So it will give you one if the entropy is zero of the density matrix. But it's going to be very small if the entropy is much bigger than one. Okay. So this is a quantity. What I'm trying to emphasize here is that this is a quantity that becomes very small when the entropy is large. Okay. So when we are computing the purity of this, this is sometimes called the purity. When we're computing this quantity using this formula, we're getting an answer which is very small when we're using this geometry. And when we get the very small answer, we should always be suspicious, because it might be that other geometries, other topologies, which are in principle exponentially suppressed, but could give us a competing answer. And that's what is happening here. So to create this geometric connection, usually we pay some price, but it might be worth paying that price if the original contribution was very small. I should emphasize that here I've drawn these diagrams at t equal to zero. And at t equal to zero, the typically this one will dominate. But it happens that at very late times, this one becomes very small and this one becomes larger. So the effect is similar in spirit to the computation of, let's say, in a black hole, we would be computing a two-point function of two operators. On a black hole. And again, that's another situation where at very late times this becomes very tiny and can receive contributions from other topologies. And those contributions from other topologies restore unitarity for this problem. That was something that was discussed by Schenker, Stanford, and Saad. Something similar in spirit is happening here. So this is again some computation that at very late times has given a very small answer. The naive geometry is giving a small answer, and the new topologies give a competing answer that is still small, but dominates at late times.
Okay, I think I'll finish there, and I'll answer more questions if you have more.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to ask actually, could you repeat at the very, over on your pictures on the right, at the very bottom, you said there's this new branch point, branch cut that appears in the middle.
Yeah, so this is, let me first draw this picture in a slightly different way. So we have this topology that connects these two. We could think of this as two disks, but we have a branch cut here that connects these two disks. Okay, so when you go into this branch cut, you come up in the upper part of this disk. Okay, so that this the topology of this surface is the same as the topology of a cylinder. Okay. Once you think about it, imagine taking this cylinder and sort of contracting it, sort of deforming it in such a way that it becomes a very thin strip that goes from the top to the bottom, right? Then we would have this configuration of cuts. It's just another way of representing the same geometry. Is that clear now?
That helps, yeah, thank you.
Yes, and then what I was drawing here is similar topologies occur for various values of n. And if we project them all when we do the, this is a picture, this is supposed to be a picture of the manifold Mn over set n, okay? And they've all been projected. Perhaps it might be clear if I draw the case n equal to 3. So,
so the bottom one is after you've taken the quotient.
Yeah, I've already taken the quotient, yeah. So that's this is the bottom line here. But let me draw the case n equal to 3. So some picture roughly like this. So we have three copies of the plane. Then we have the three disks on each plane. They are joined by a surface that roughly looks like this. Okay. Of course, there are also the branch cuts, the blue branch cuts, which are, again, we're setting up the computation. And these are also joined, right? So this is joined to here and so on, right? And this whole picture has a CN, C3 in this case, symmetry. And there are C3 fixed points. There is one here in the front and one in the back of this surface. And when we take the CM quotient, we get this type of picture.
Okay. No, thank you. That helps. Thank you. We had another. Somebody use the chat. Okay. Yov is asking, is there a paper with a proof that the cosmic brain term you wrote gives a deficit angle of 2 pi over n? They saw a particular example in a paper by Bill Lincoln from 81. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So I think the question you're asking is whether a cosmic brain or a cosmic string fixes this deficit angle, right? Is that the question? Okay. Let me.
I guess maybe they don't have a mic, so they're having to use that.
Just mention. Imagine you have Einstein gravity, right? You have this action. So Einstein gravity in d dimensions. So this is our d dimensional space. And then you have the action with some tension on a manifold of dimension d minus 2, right? Of square root of g, right? So this is the induced metric on this d minus 2 dimensional manifold. And this is the Einstein term, okay? So then if you have this situation very near this manifold, so let's say we have some space, we have sigma, and then we have the overall space. And when we look very near one of these points, there are two transverse dimensions. So I'm going to draw these two transverse dimensions here. So there are two transverse dimensions, and at this point, there is a deficit angle. So the space looks conical around this point. So there's the angle between here and here. Is a fraction of 2 pi that depends on the ratio of the tension divided by 1 over g Newton. And I don't know the original reference for this, but it's in a few places. So, And
any last questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, can you comment a bit more maybe on the relation of this the solution and the information paradox with respect to the formulation of the paradox in terms of correlators and the lifetime decay of correlators?
The question is the relationship between this information paradox and the information paradox in terms of correlators?
Yeah.
Yes. The information paradox in terms of correlators, so do you have in mind this two-point functions at late times, or?
Yes,
okay. Well, it is somewhat similar in the sense that the computation of the Rennie entropy, especially the second Rennie entropy, or the nth Rennie entropy, is a computation of a complicated operator at late times, right? So you prepare the state at time equal to zero, and then you compute the expectation value of a complicated operator. Let me be more precise. So. So when you compute the, let's say, trace rho squared, right, that is equal to the expectation value of something called the swap operator, which is the following. So if you have two copies of the system, what this operator is doing is sort of swapping the two copies of the system. Okay. And for the nth case, you are swapping them in a cyclic way. So you can think of this as an expectation values in two copies of the system. So you prepare two physical copies, and then you compute this expectation value of an operator like this. And in this way, you can compute the these entropies. And this is a way in which people actually in the lab can compute Rennie entropies. They prepare two copies, and then they apply this operator, they measure the expectation value. Now, one feature of this expectation value is that if the system is in a pure state, then this will be one, okay? So it has a large expectation value. But if the system is entropic state, in a relatively high entropy state, this expectation value will be very small. Okay. Now, in the case of the black hole, of an evaporating black hole, what happens is that at late times, this expectation value is becoming very small and it's going to zero. Okay. So it's similar to what was happening to the two-point function of simple operators. Again, at short times, it's maybe relatively high, and very long times, it's going all the way to zero. And in both cases, unitarity implies that it cannot go all the way to zero. Okay. So in this case, it should go to some minimal value, which would be the thermodynamic entropy of the system. In the case of the two-point function, again, it should have some random fluctuations, which are of order e to the minus entropy of the system. So the two are somewhat similar. The difference is that this operator is a more complicated operator than the simple operators that were considered in the long time correlators. That's the main difference. And also this operator then has the physical interpretation as measuring the entropy after you continue in in the replica index.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Eric, I have a question. I mean, can you hear me?
Can you hear Eric?
No, I cannot hear you.
Okay, maybe come closer. I'm not 100% sure if it works.
So you explained that in the case of the evaporating black hole, the additional extremal surface was there because you could balance the term from the matter and the gravity?
Yes.
And so is this also similar in this wormhole calculation, that the additional settle point that you find, I mean, can that suggest that the solution only exists if you also include the matter Lagrange?
Yes, that's right. So
because the calculation is fully gravitational, but you somehow in finding or stabilizing the solution, you probably need the full equation.
Yes, so, yeah, so this replica wormholes, but especially these ones that we were discussing here in Euclidean space are probably only exist, I think they only exist thanks to these quantum corrections. They are very similar to these other wormholes that we discussed. So imagine the same type of two copies of the black hole, right? And now you put some direct interactions at the boundaries of the black hole, from here to here, and from here to here, and from here to here, and so on, right? Then in these situations, when you connect the two boundaries, it can happen that you get a non-trivial wormhole solution, right? This is what you were referring to, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So this type of thing is somewhat similar. So this cracks here are similar to the connections that we have here between the two boundaries. So we're putting some direct interactions between the two boundaries, and then we're getting this connected geometry.
Okay.
Now, there's been a discussion of whether if we don't have those connections, whether there are wormholes that are still relevant or not. Okay. Certainly, if we don't have these connections, I think there are no solutions. However, there are some simple theories like this JT gravity theory and so on, where they can still be wormholes. Maybe they are off-shell configurations and they can still connect, and they might give a connected contribution. And in those cases, those are interpreted as in the dual theory as coming from an average over couplings. So we have a system, these gravity theories are not dual to a theory with a single set of couplings, but with are dual to a theory where we're averaging over couplings. And then in that case, even though we set up a computation that does not have any obvious direct connection, because we are averaging over couplings, we effectively we can have these connections, and they arise due to the average over couplings.
Okay.
So an example of this is the in the first paper by Stanford, Schenker and Saad. They considered the spectral form factor, so the partition function of beta plus IT model squared, and in that computation they found a connected contribution, which again, if you had a single system, it wouldn't make sense. But if you average over systems over Hamiltonians, then it makes sense.
Yeah, did you want to? No, that's
okay.
Anyone else?
And I feel maybe I'd say a general comment, which is that this type of things where you find these geometric connections have made people think again about the idea of wormholes that connect different spacetimes and the role of wormholes in information paradox. And so this had been discussed before by, in the past, I don't know, 30 years ago, by Giddings and Strominger and Coleman. And there was also a paper by Polchinski and Strominger, who suggested that perhaps connections between black hole interiors could play a role in restoring the information for black holes. And I think the picture that one is getting through these formulas is somewhat similar to the pictures that were suggested in those papers. And the role of having average over couplings is unclear to me. So, and I think you could interpret this as saying that we should fundamentally average over couplings. And there are indeed some very simple gravity theories which are dual to systems with average couplings, such as the JT gravity theory. And I'm not sure, I think it's an interesting thing, and how that impacts what we think about string theory or higher dimensional gravity is a bit unclear, because it's somehow at odds with what we think normally. So normally when we do string theory, we think we have this unique theory with single couplings, everything is determined, while in these two-dimensional models like JT gravity, the dual systems have, it's dual to an ensemble of systems rather than one particular system.
Juan, a question?
Yeah.
do you have something to say about the role of wormholes with the insight that you gain from here? Do you have something to say about wormholes that are not connecting interiors of black holes?
Well, I think this is, again, this issue about the average over couplings and so on. In all these cases, they are somehow connected to the black hole interior or slightly outside the black hole interior. Certainly, in the case of black holes, is a case where the contribution of the wormholes becomes crucial. Maybe they are also present when we don't have black holes, but they give very tiny effects. There might be other situations where they also become important that haven't been discovered yet. So you would expect that in situations where you have lots of matter that is entangled, what matter is entangled with itself, it would be relevant.
And another question that may be a little too naive, in the pictures that you draw, they look, I mean, they remind me of closed string exchange. And also when you draw the N equals 3 and higher cases, do I read something more into it?
Well, in the particular case, well, first of all, these were two-dimensional pictures. These similar pictures would hold in higher dimensions where you wouldn't be like closed string exchange, would be brain exchange or whatever. But in the particular case of two-dimensional gravity, so you can think of two-dimensional gravity as the worksheet of some kind of string. Let's say non-critical string or whatever, some general or supercritical string. And in that case, indeed, you could think of it that way.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, I think we should thank Juan again.